Welcome back to the Jordan Syatt Mini Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. In this episode, I speak with none other than James Smith, who is an extraordinary fitness coach from the UK, currently living in Australia. And just to be very clear, we do not talk much about fitness at all in this podcast. We don't talk about calories. We don't talk about protein. We don't really talk about strength training. We really just hang out and talk about random stuff. So I hope you enjoy the episode. If you do, please leave a 5-star review. Make sure you follow James on all of his social media outlets. I'll give a link to some of those in the show notes. Have a wonderful day. Let's get into it. All right. James, you there?
I am there indeed.
What's up, dude?
Not a lot, mate. Not a lot. A bit cool in Sydney. A lot cooler than last time we spoke. But I'm good, mate. I like the time difference that you and I have, seeing as the UK at the moment is my 6 a.m. It's their 9 p.m. So, you know, being on a podcast at 9:30 in the morning, I've got my coffee in, I'm great.
And you, when was the last time you were back in the UK? Because you live in Australia most of the time?
Yeah, I was back in February. I came here in February, so what we are now, June. So I was back there for a few months over Christmas. Usually 6 months or 4 or 5 months in the UK, the rest of the time in Sydney. So when it gets to about May, I would usually go home. I was supposed to come home via LA. And yeah, with America closing the borders, it's been a little bit strange. I've had my visa extended in Australia, but yeah, I'm not sure when I'm going to go home.
Got it. How did you end up first going to Australia?
Do you know what? I never really wanted to go. I was quite happy in the UK. I was working in a budget gym in Bracknell. Cost the equivalent £20 a month, so maybe even $20, because US dollar and pounds pretty similar. Yeah. So I was in a budget gym. I was happy, man. My rent for the month in that gym was about £360. So less than $400 for the month. I got free rein of full PT. And then, yeah, I went to a festival in Croatia and I met a bunch of Australian guys. A few of them were PTs. And we hit it pretty hard. And I don't know, one night at the festival, I was just chatting to one of the lads and I was like, I'm going to move to Australia. And I went about 6 weeks later. It was like a bit of a midlife crisis. I think I was 27 and I was bored, which I think is an emotion a lot of people struggle to deal with, where they suppress it. They think their situation will get better if they suppress boredom, but often it actually just gets worse.
Interesting. Wait, so was there any middle ground there? Was there any like, did you have a conversation with someone? Like, did they say you should move to Australia? You should go? Like, what, did you just like pop in your head, I want to go?
Yeah, it just literally came to me. I won't incriminate myself too much, but I'd taken a psychedelic substance at the time. And it just felt right. And do you know what? I was expecting pushback from my dad. So me and my dad having a barbecue, we're in the back garden, and I drop it on him. I go, I might go to Australia. And he was like, do you know what? Always imagined you ending up somewhere like that. And it was exactly nothing what I expected to hear from him. So I booked my flight. My mum was like, no, you know, go get it out of your system for a few months. And 3.5 years later, I'm still living between here and the UK.
Your dad I know literally nothing about him other than like some of the things you wrote in your book. And I know you said in your book that he was giving you £100 a month or something. And then it got to a point where he was like, all right, man, you gotta work now. Like, talk about that.
So my old man, that's an English terminology for my dad. I'm going to make sure I translate everything to that. So my old man's like a corporate, put a suit on at 16, wore it for the next 50 years, worked at the same business. So he understands like working hard for something and being consistent. And he was like, right, if you go to university, I will give you £100 a month, so $100 a month. That'll help you get some sausage rolls, some beers, whatever it is. That'll help you get through it. And when I finished university, I kind of was just living with some friends and he cut me off. I was like, Dad, what are you doing? Like, you know, I'm your son.
And he didn't tell you that he was cutting you off, did he?
No, he just stopped me. He was like, well, you're not at university anymore, son. You get a job. And I remember saying to him, there are no jobs. And that now I don't listen to a lot of my friends or people that I know when they go, there's no jobs. I'm like, there are. There are always jobs. There are just none that you've inquired for and none that you want to do. So, He actually said to me, he was like, sign on. So go get like a benefit allowance. And I was haunted by that. I'd always considered myself someone that wouldn't sponge off the state. I sponged off my parents, fine, but not the state. And he goes, James, I've been working for 50 years. I've been paying a lot of tax. He was like, you know, that's what it's there for. So I think he passively aggressively sent me to the job centre, so I would then have to go through the process of signing on. And I was horrified at how easy it was in the UK to get state benefits.
Yeah. You called it the dole, right? The dole in your book? I didn't know what it meant in the book, but that's what I assumed you were talking about.
Yeah, so you got people in the UK like, yeah, living on the dole. And I went in there and I was like, right, okay, what do I need to do? They were like, right, every Friday you come in, here's your bit of paper. Write down the three things that you've done to try and get work. And I was like, all right. And I was like, do I need to prove it to you, send you emails? She was like, no, just write it down. And I was like, what? So hold on, I can write down that I sent an email without proving to them I sent the email, and that was enough. And I went up to this touchscreen machine and I took the first job, which was door-to-door sales. And yeah, that's in the book. I was door-to-door salesman for gas and electric.
You made it sound so bad in the book. Like, you really like did not sugarcoat it at all. You're like, this is awful.
Yeah, because everyone's got gas and electric already. So you're knocking on someone's door to try and say, to sell them a better rate. And they come through the same pipes and the same wires. It's just which service you're going to have.
Right.
But the worst thing is everyone thinks you're there to read their meter. So I'm not sure if it's the same in the States, like the gas man might come, you like check the meter and they see how much you've been using. So everyone's like, come in. And then when they realize I'm there to sell them a product, they're like, hold on, I'm not with Empower, I'm with British Gas. I was like, exactly. They're like, get out of here, get the fuck out. They were like, so straight away I'd have to go out with my tail between my legs. And the area of the UK I was in was shit. It was winter. We were supposed to wear this stupid uniform with a red like fleece.
Yeah.
And I was like, nah. I was like, I wore a suit that I had from the prom. I was like going a bit rogue.
You wore a suit that you had from your high school prom?
Yeah, it was like a gray suit.
Like a tux suit?
No, it wasn't a tux. It was like it was a gray suit with a white shirt. And I just thought it looked a bit more formal. and then I looked a bit more like a salesman. But it was rubbish. And my old man, I think he knew once I got a taste of what work was like, I'd realize what the real world was like. But I've always said it to people, and especially in the book, is that if you knock on doors and you're used to a lot of things not working, if you're okay with that, it makes marketing a lot easier, because you and I both email marketing campaigns. You send an email to 100,000 people. If 1% buy from you that day, that's amazing. Yeah. So, you know, we live in a world where adverts on TV, sales, clicks, whatever, if even 1% works, that's great marketing. Then, you know, asking a girl for a number in a bar or someone out on a date, your percentages are much higher than that. So it kind of set me up that when I got into personal training, you know, whenever I went to ask someone if they're interested in PT, I knew that someone in the gym on their own was a lot more likely to need a personal trainer than someone at home watching TV, having someone come around to read the meter would want to switch to another provider.
How did you make that transition into going from door-to-door salesman to being a personal trainer?
When I gave up door-to-door sales, I remember, again, chatting to my parents. I was like, I'm coming home. They're like, why? I was like, I need to get on with life. Like, I was living in like a university bubble still. I was living with friends in where I was doing door-to-door sales in Gloucester. And I'm quite a relatively tidy person. So I make my bed every day. I like things being in the right place. And I would come into the kitchen, just little things like they would leave shelves open. And I'd be like, guys, like, you've got a plate out. How hard is it to just shut the cupboard door once you've got a plate out? I was like, I don't feel like I'm asking for much here. Or, you know, things would just be left in the sink. I'd be like, guys, this is the dishwasher. And then I remember once one of my friends was really sarcastic. And when I would moan to him, he would accidentally drop a plate or smash a glass. So that every time I moaned, like Pavlov's dog, he'd break something. So it would stop me complaining. Then people started, they started playing this game. I didn't realize till a couple months, where our house came fully furnished. And the lady that rented us the house, I apologize if she's listening. We went there in jeans and we spoke very properly. And we're like, oh yes, you know, we're students. We need somewhere to live. And my neighbors opposite were rugby players as well. And every time we went out drinking, they would take one item from the house on the night out. And I didn't realize this at first. And then about 3 weeks in, I'm on the dance floor in a place called Liquid in Gloucester. And there's a wooden duck that is a doorstop from my house in a girl's arms on the dance floor. And I go up to her. I'm like, that's from my house. Who did you get that off? And she points over to a guy who's my neighbor. And I'm like, what's going on? What's that doing in here? So I couldn't live in this like frat house mentality anymore. So I went home and had to begin the real world. And I got a job in sales. And sales is such a broad, nuanced term. And funnily enough, actually, one of the guys I live with in Sydney, when I moved in, I put out like a little feeler for needing somewhere to live. When I moved in and when I came to see the house, I looked at him and I was like, I know you from somewhere. And he went to university near Ryan, to the university. And I was like, I know you from somewhere. We sat back to back in my first ever job in Reading in the UK.
Wow.
So like the other side of the world, I was like, we worked at the same business, the first place, the first office I ever worked in. And we're in separate teams, but I recognized his face.
That's insane. And I was like,
yeah, he had no idea when he messaged me about living there or anything. I looked a bit different 10 years ago. And yeah, so we live together now. And in essence, I was just bashing the phones. And I was like, do you know what? Calling people to make money is so much easier than knocking on doors. I'm warm. I've got a peanut butter Nutella sandwich right by me. I can, you know, go. I just sit here all day. And I had a seat where there was a window behind me. So I do no work during the day. I would, you know, I knew for the first 3 months they'd let me get away with not making many good sales. So I used to call the same number maybe 30, 40 times in the morning. Then I'd leave it on hold for like an hour so that my average call time would be a few minutes. So like my managers were like, James, mate, you're making fantastic progress. You're averaging 3 minutes a call. That's a great amount of time to keep people on. And,
Wait, what would you do for that hour?
You know, I'd just make it look like I was working hard. And then when winter came around, I realized that when it got dark outside, it made the glass behind me reflective so people could see that I wasn't working and I was playing games. So I decided to have a career change then because they moved me away from the window. And I went to another like sales office where in essence, it was actually for an American business. It's called EMC, like a big tech company.
Yeah.
And we did like, I was in an IT security place there. And I was just, you know, on the phones, qualifying sales in this office environment. And it was actually quite easy. So many people wanted this product online and they needed it from a legal standpoint. I just had to call them up and see how big a deal it would be and then pass it on to the respective people. Now, not many people in IT sales or even in technology sales will disclose this, but the job is so easy. And I wouldn't say it's corrupt, but imagine this. I'm in a basic role. I'm on like $20,000 a year. And I'm this guy who has to qualify all of these sales and we have to decide where they go. And you know, like if you want a Mars bar or a Snickers, you don't go to Mars, you don't go to Snickers, you buy it from the shop. The shop get it from distribution get it from Mars, whatever. So very much the same in technology sectors. This happens the same. So if you need a solution or some kind of software, you don't go straight to the guy, you go to a reseller. My first week at work, these guys call me up. They're like, James, we're going to take you for dinner, have a few beers. I was like, guys, you're calling the wrong person. I'm on like $20,000 a year. I just call up the phone. They go, nah, James, you're the right person. Come to us. I was like, all right. So they go, basically, mate, you're going to come across some relatively big deals, some small deals. And he goes, I think you should give the big deals to us and not our competitors. So I'm having a few beers and I'm like, oh yeah, why is that? And he goes, because the way the system works, we don't have to put our big sales through Salesforce. And he goes, what we can do is we can give you the heads up, get you to put it in Salesforce, and then put it back through us. So if I gave them all the big deals that came through the business website, they were going to give me big deals before they went through theirs so that I would log it in my system. I could make up any story I wanted. You know, I was just working through the network, calling up an old lead, managed to discover this opportunity. And these guys were like, yeah, cheers, James, for giving the deal. We got this big renewal for you. I wasn't even working in renewals. So I put it in the system first. My manager will come down. She go, James, how did you come across that? They're not even in your network. I was like, you know, I asked them if I could help them with anything. They mentioned this renewal. She's like, James, that's a $400,000 deal. I would have the whole team around my desk applauding me. I got given this like, it's like an iPad, but it was by like Samsung. And they were giving me Amazon vouchers. I wasn't doing any work apart from qualifying a few things that came in, giving them all to one business. All the other businesses in this realm didn't actually even know my name. They're like, James, is he an inside sales? We've never heard from him because I wasn't sending them anything. And in all of these businesses that I've been in, there's such an easy way to have an easy ride. And so many people, you know, they work these corporate jobs saying, oh, I've had such a long day at work. I'm like, no, you haven't. You sit down. You're fucking around with your emails. You're going to the water cooler. You're having a coffee. You're doing this. They're like, oh, I've got another meeting. I'm like, you and three other people are going for a chat. Don't call it a meeting. You're going for a chat. That's an hour off of work where you got to pretend you're listening. And I was bored again. So from that, went to play rugby in New Zealand for a season. Very hard to get a work-life balance when you don't have any work. So then I was pretty much just full-time rugby. Came back, got into an office again. I was like, I was a lost soul. Clean shaven again. Went into recruitment this time. A year in, I fucking hated it. I hate the bullshit that goes on in an office. Mm-hmm. Everyone's just pretending to be nice to each other. Hey, James, how was your weekend? And I would like lie back to them. I was like, you know, dinner with friends. I wasn't having dinner with friends. I had a bin bag around my neck from being on the bus coming back from Devon, which is a 4-hour trip, having to puke in a bin bag to stop the bus driver getting mad and going out into some dirty nightclub in somewhere in London. And I realized I just didn't fit in with this kind of like structure of the corporate world. Went to Asia for 6 months.
Where in
then
Asia?
I came back. Yeah, I went to Thailand, Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam.
That's awesome.
Didn't train for 6 months. And I drank beer every single day.
Do you go by yourself?
Oh, here we go. I went with a girlfriend.
Okay.
My mum warned me before. She goes, James.
She knew she wasn't for you.
I wouldn't go traveling with a girlfriend. I'm like, what do you know, mum? This is love. A month in, she was doing my head in. And it got to the point that I was fabricating arguments so that I could say, I'm not having this. And I'd go out with other people that we'd meet during the day. And then you kind of end up sunk cost fallacy. People struggle to walk away from things they've invested in. For me,
explain the sunk cost. Let's go into it because I think it's super important. And I know you discuss it in your book.
So we make irrational decisions based on how long we've been invested into something.
Yep.
We're not pragmatic about whether or not we should be invested, just on how long. So a lot of investments. You could invest in stocks and they don't move for 2 years. And you're like, well, I've been investing for 2 years. I should probably hold on to them.
Yep.
And really, you're like, no, mate, that's not worked. And the same with a fitness plan. A lot of people do fitness plans, not because they work, but they've been doing them for so long, they don't want to walk away. And in relationships, you have the same. And for me, I'd committed leaving my job, going to Asia, doing all this traveling, even though I was fucking hating every day with her. I'd gone so far, I was like, I can't walk away now. You know, we've been in Asia for two months. And so I'd drink a lot in the evenings just so, you know, I could numb her out because she was doing my head in. We'd meet other couples and usually like the girls would get on and me and the other guys would just get absolutely smashed. And when I got to Laos, I hadn't been training in about 6-7 weeks. And I was like,
like weight training or rugby training?
Any training.
Nothing. Got it.
Like maybe get my steps up a bit. So I see this gym because the gym culture in Asia is not quite as what it is in the Western world. So I go into the gym and I was quite fit when I was working in the office. I'd go there on my lunch breaks. You know, I'm quite anti the bro split. Mm-hmm. I would have a little pot on my desk with 5 bits of paper, legs, arms, chest, back, shoulders. And because at the time I thought that was the best way for me to get hench, swole, my whole drawer full of supplements. So I knew how to train a bit. I go into the gym and I was like, right, 60 kg back squat, maybe, you know, 4 sets of 10, something like that. I do 1 set of 6 and I was like, oh, that's pretty hard. It's pretty hard. And I was like, right, maybe 4 sets of 6. I do my 2nd set of 6. I literally thought my hamstrings were going to explode. Not even my quads, which was strange. And I was there like, have I just pulled a muscle for the first time? And I was like, right, tried doing a few other exercises. Nothing was really sticking. I was so concerned about getting savage cramps in my hamstrings that I ended up going for a swim. Went for a swim and I was like, James, mate, you are so deconditioned. It's not even worth training. Not even worth training. So I took the next 3 months
off
training.
You're still out of shape. Why even bother?
Yeah, that I just put myself through pain. It was like I'd it was really shit. And I continued doing traveling. Then one day I had a big blow up with the missus and I was like, I can't do this anymore. Broke up with her in Thailand. Yeah, not ideal. I put in an ultimatum. I said, if we argue tonight, full moon party in Thailand, I'm done. 2 hours later, big argument. I was like, I'm not doing this. She was like, I want to go to Australia. I was like, see you later. I'm going back to the UK.
Do you remember what that argument was about?
Yeah, I think I was telling the story and I was exaggerating and it was pissing her off. And yeah, man, it wasn't great. And do you know what? The 4 days I had in Thailand on my own were probably the best out of the whole trip.
Yeah.
But I was pretty fat. And I knew it at the time, but I was like, right, I'm going to go back. I'm getting back into it. As soon as I got off the plane, I went for a run, got to the gym membership, bought some protein. And for the next 2-3 weeks while I was out of work, I was just getting fit. And my sister says to me, she was like, why don't you become a PT? She was like, in the office where I used to be, I was giving people advice. They'd be having, you know, porridge for breakfast. I'd be like, I thought you were trying to lose weight. He's like, yeah, but it's good for me. I was like, I didn't know much about nutrition. I was like, you could probably do better. I was like, have some eggs. Like, you know, trying to do these things. And my sister was like, you're the fitness dickhead of the office. Why not become a PT? So I was like, you know what? If I give it a go, if I do 3 sessions for £30 a day, call it $100 a day, I can do all right on that. It paid the same basic as my sales salary. I go to work in shorts. I could go in there from 9 till 12. And no one telling me off of pissing about on a computer. No having to, you know, get bored in the office. I was like, I could earn the same money and not be bored. And turn up to the gym. This would have breached GDPR, but it was a good few years ago. I was one of only 2 PTs in the gym that had 2,000 members. So in my head, I was like, oh, maybe no one here wants to do PT. And I go into the office and I was like, can I email the database, you know? And he was like, yeah, sure.
You didn't know anything about email marketing at that time, did you?
No, I hadn't. But what I had done in sales is emailed a lot of people.
Got it.
Emails in, hey, it's James. I'd then say I was working on behalf of this company. Just wanted to know if there was anything that I could do to help. If so, give me a call back on this. So I structured an email. I had a footer in there, my number, like little basic things. And
they let you email the entire list?
They didn't even do that. They exported the entire database of signed up to the gym. But before GDPR, this is fine because they had opted into marketing. So technically the gym were like, you're marketing yourself to them. So I exported 2,000 emails. I put it into blind carbon copy in Gmail, which again, not a lot of people that hadn't worked in corporate would know how to not make it look like a mass email. And I was like, hi, my name's James. I'm one of the new personal trainers. Just wanted to reach out to see if there's anything I can do to help. Under no obligation, if you ever see me in the gym, you're not sure how to use any bit of equipment, grab me, pull me aside, be more than happy to help.
Wow.
Cheers. First email, bang. I've got 20 clients in my first week of being a PT. And I'm like, whoa, I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. But suddenly, even the other PT was like, how the hell has he got this many clients? Did he bring them with him or what? And the majority of them had actually stopped using the gym altogether. So they saw it as a good opportunity to get back into it. And that meant that my first year or 2 years of personal training, I was doing between 30 and 50 hours of PT a week.
Jeez, it's a lot.
Yeah. And I'd made the mistake of everyone else. I was doing, I remember once I did 14 one-hour sessions in a day. And I'm sure you've been there as well, right?
Yeah, that's awful, man. My back is hurting just like thinking about that.
And in your head, you're like, this is what I should be doing. This is amazing. Oh my God, I've made 14 times 30. But you're so tired. And the last 3 sessions, you're not actually there in your head. You feel like giving them back their money when they walk out the door.
Yeah. I've always said if I ever, I mean, I don't think I'll ever open a gym, but just from my experience coaching for years on the floor, if I ever was in charge of a gym and coaches, I wouldn't allow a coach to coach more than 2 hours in a row at any one time. Like you have to go 2 hours and you have to take at least a 30 minute to an hour break or do something else, build their online presence, something. Cause you're 100% with someone on your, like in conversation, listening to what they're saying, looking at their technique. It's impossible to give that for multiple hours in a row.
100%. And then you start hyping yourself up on caffeine or you end up going for a piss when you don't need a piss, just so you can have a minute to yourself. You end up, suddenly in the office, you have these meetings, but they're not intense. What you now have are one-to-one meetings with high-paying, important customers who can potentially refer you business through their progress. Mm-hmm. Everything, suddenly I wasn't bored. I was super in tune with my business because you're not like working for someone else. You're working for your own brand and mm-hmm. everything's so important and texting clients back or whatever it is. And I got very busy very early, but completely neglected how to run a business for the first 2 years. And it was kind of a tough education. It was only about 2 years in that I realized that I could commoditize that I could limit my hours, put my rates up because of that. And even now I have talks with quite a lot of people that I say to them, if you limit what you offer, suddenly you can charge more for it. And they're like, oh my God, that's amazing. And then I say, and another thing that people really need to understand is that what you charge in an hour isn't your take home, because arguably half of that is spent in being your business. Coffees, the laptop we're doing this call on, the microphone I'm speaking through, your profit, your take home is probably half your hourly rate. So when PTs pull their pants down and give people a discount, if they think they're giving someone a 10% discount, they're actually taking a third less money home. Mm-hmm. And if someone actually increases their rates by 10%, they're taking home sometimes three times or like 30% more money. And as a personal trainer, when you first understand that, because no one teaches us this kind of maths when we learn to be a PT, we should know the difference between all the deadlifts, but we don't know the difference between managing like different monetary values. And when I say to some coaches, I'm like, hey, bro, if you put your rates up by 15% and you lose a load of your clients, you will earn the same money to go home on a Thursday than you would to put your rates down and have to work till Saturday to earn the same money.
That makes a lot of sense. It's interesting. That is a conversation. I know you do a lot of work with coaches like to help build their business. And it's something a lot of coaches, I think Instagram has lowered the barrier of entry for people to become coaches, right? So I know for when you and I became a coach, we did a lot of work to become a coach. We did a lot of work to study, to learn about everything that we're going through. I think a lot of people, they want to become a coach because of the things that they're seeing on Instagram. Maybe they hired a coach, they enjoyed it. They're like, oh, you know what? I sort of want to do this thing too. One of the things that I've started to recommend to coaches who are brand new to coaching and they're struggling to get clients at all, but they're being told they need to charge more, is I'm a huge fan of actually coaching people for free when you first start. Right, like doing something for free, mainly because they don't know very much, right? They don't know, if they know nothing at all, they know, or just based on the things they've seen from Instagrams, the swipe workouts, whatever it is. It's like when coaches first start, I'm a huge fan of offering free coaching at the beginning, because realistically, it's like, if you haven't invested much time or money into your education, are you really worth what you're charging? As coaches get better and better and better, I think what you're saying is super important, because I think most people become a personal trainer and spend a lot of time studying to become a personal trainer because they actually want to help people. Like they really do. They really care. I know a lot of coaches feel guilty about charging more, right? A lot of coaches, like, they feel like something's wrong when they want to charge more money. So I think it's super important for them to hear, like, it's okay to charge more money to increase your rates if you've put in the time and effort to be a great coach.
Yeah, there's a big issue with people's self-worth where when I do these talks, I say, hey guys, put your hands up if you're doing more than 30 hours of PT. And the hands that go up, I'm like, you're too fucking cheap. And they're like, what? I'm like, how do I know? Because you're doing more than 30 hours. In the onset, like definitely say people train their friends, train their family, get to understand how people move, how a session is entailed. Sometimes you'll have an issue with people wanting to jump on free stuff, but like you say, it helps build that person's confidence, because I'm sure you were the same. I felt like I was robbing people for my first year. In my head, I was like, would I pay someone this kind of money to do it? Probably not. And then I have a coach at the moment. One of my friends is a fighter in Bali. He's in Sydney, and I said to him, I need to pay you for these sessions. He was like, all right, cool. And then he's a bit funny about asking for it, because we were friends before he was my coach. Mm-hmm. And he taught me this grip break, a judo grip break. So he's a black belt in judo, he's a brown belt in jiu-jitsu.
Jeez.
And I was like, this is a really nice grip break, blah, blah, blah. And I said, I'm going to pay you for today. And he goes, no, don't worry about it. And I said, stop worrying about you. This grip break to me is worth more than what I'm paying you. And that's all that's important. What he taught me on that day, I was like, this is worth the money to me. This isn't about you. This is about me. And so I got him to take himself out of his shoes. Stop worrying about what you're charging me. Start worrying about what I learned from the hour. And with people's clients, instead of worrying as a trainer, like, how much am I worth? Ask them, how much is that session worth to them? And when it becomes about them, you don't just turn up as a coach. You turn up and be like, how can I help you? What can I teach you? What are you struggling with? Because if someone's struggling with something, you take that struggle away, that's worth so much more than the hour, or the session, or the training. And I'm training with him again in probably the next hour. I only go to him with problems. He takes them away. And I say to him, bro, I'll pay you twice what I just paid you then to make that problem go away. 2 years' time, if something happens in competition or when my friends are watching or whatever it is, you know, that's worth its weight in gold. And I think that's really the premium of, you know, it's not, oh, am I getting paid $1 a minute? It's, I'm letting someone pay me to make their problems go away. And for so many people, that's worth their weight massively.
I've never heard anyone frame it that way. It's a super good point, because one of the things that I think that will happen to a lot of coaches, especially if they're coaching someone for a long time, they'll start to feel like, well, they already know everything, right? It's like once you teach a client as much as they need to know, right? They understand energy balance. They understand what they need to do for strength training. There are a number of clients who they'll stay with you for a long time, even when they know exactly what to do. And I feel a lot of coaches, and speaking from personal experience, there's a feeling of guilt that comes on, like being like, why are you continuing to pay me? Like, you know what to do. But the way that you phrase it, it's like, it's not about you, it's about them. And even you just being there for accountability, just to keep them accountable, to keep them feeling like they don't have to, you take all the guesswork out of it. That's worth it for them in order to stay consistent with their training and nutrition.
Yeah, I had an issue once where I was trying to sign someone up to see me 3 times a week. And this is when I was charging a lot more. And she goes, I only really want to see you twice. She goes, I'll do the third session myself. And I said to her, I was in the onset of building my business in Sydney. I go, if you see me that third time, you never have to bring a program to the gym. And I knew she was a busy corporate. She earned really good money because I knew the business she was in. And she went, I'll see you 3 times a week. It wasn't about the amount I was charging per week. I go, you never have to bring a program because every session you come to, I'll be there. And it's about how you frame that to people. And again, I love actually now paying for coaching when I learn stuff because I get so excited to be in the shoes. And, you know, it's for people that have busy lives, like I order my meals in, nothing makes me happier than having to worry about cooking food. And I pay someone else to do it. And a lot of coaches need to put themselves in the mindset of very busy people. For us, we love being in control of our training, but for other people, they want to let it go.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, so when, you know, if someone that wants to come in and pay that money, you are taking a problem away from them where they can just give you the money for it to take care of itself.
Yep.
And that's really the proposition people need to have as coaches in whatever they're doing. And, you know, even if someone's a masseuse, they go, oh, I can't charge this money for a massage session. You could eradicate someone's stress and give them the 1 hour of their day where they're not on their phone, the 1 hour of their day where they can actually like switch off. It's about taking things out of context and really understanding, you know, you're not just giving someone a haircut, you're making them feel more confident about themselves. And people really need to, yeah, get on board with that and understand that their services are not just time for money. And then when people start believing in their own services, it can make them more confident. And my favorite kind of point that I also bring out in my B2B talks is I go, if your iPhone charger stops working and you go on eBay or Amazon and there's one for $10, $10, $10, $22, you will buy the $22 one because you know it's not going to let you down. It's not going to break. The other ones, you'll always have that doubt. And if you buy a cheaper one and it messes you about, you'll be so frustrated with yourself that you opted for the cheaper one, because you've had to buy it twice.
Mm-hmm.
And so many coaches are worried of being the most expensive. And I'm like, guys, you're going to get the best clients. You know, Tesla, right? Tesla cars are unreal. The customers they attract through keeping their standards so high, everyone just gets top spec. Because if they're going to invest that much money in a car anyway, why would they not get the best one? And the people that don't want to invest in a good iPhone charger and not the best clients because they're shopping on price, not on quality. So even if you deliver them the best session in the world, they won't be happy with it.
Makes total sense. But how did you go from in-person coaching to online coaching?
By accident. I started building an email list just for, you know, everyone's like, you got to build a list, you got to build a list. One day, you'll want to release.
Were you making online content at that point?
I was mostly blog orientated at this point. I'd write little blogs, sweeteners, sweet potato versus normal potato.
Yeah.
Just trying to.
You had a website. Answer.
Yeah, yeah. So my housemate at the time built me a website. I started a little WordPress, started doing little blogs.
What year was this in?
2015, I reckon.
Got it. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
And then I would then start posting pictures. I first got the app to know how to put wording on a picture. But the thing is, I was ripping all my pictures off Google Images. And it got to the point where I didn't realize at the time, but when I had like 6,000 followers, the people from those images were them reaching out to me, like, you can't use my fucking picture. And for me, like, I didn't think of this. I didn't know. No one told me this.
Of course.
I was like, it's fair game. And I got this chick from like somewhere in America going, you've written a low carb post and used my picture. I'm not endorsing what you're saying. And I was like, oh shit. So I kept building this email list, and I was trying to sell PT through an email list, but I didn't realize that the geographical restrictions. Then I tried a PDF plan where for $20, you got a plan where I explained energy balance and what a calorie deficit is.
For $28?
$20, it wasn't even that, it was $19.99. And I was like, in essence, what I got them to do was map out, write down everything they eat for a week, identify five changes where they could reduce the calories, try it out the next week and see what the result was. And then it was result orientated, and it was like a methodology where people didn't have to track, didn't have to use my fitness power, gave them the option to use it. And I was like, for £20, I can teach someone a deficit. No one really fucking bought it. Even my own clients that I saw face to face were buying it. I was like, cheers, thanks, it's nice. And I was getting paid what I thought £20 to send an email. So if three people bought it, I was like, sweet, I've just made fucking £60 in 5 minutes. Then when I did decide to go to Australia, about a month before that, a guy I trained called Cliff, he goes, you're going to train me. I was like, sweet, come in, we'll talk it out. He was like, I'm in Dubai. I was like, mate, this is a long way to come for a PT session. And he was like, no, you can train me online. I go, I don't know how. He goes, well, learn. I was like, all right. I was like, just to let you know, I have no idea what I'm doing here. He goes, that's fine. He goes, I don't trust the dickheads in my gym. So I said, all right, how much shall I charge? And he was like, I don't know, how much do you want? I was like, how about you pay me what I charge for an hour, which was £55 at the time, and I will ensure I give you an hour of my time every week. He goes, fine. He goes, can you write me a program? So I was like, okay. Then I got someone to make a PDF program, and I just chat with him on WhatsApp throughout the day. How did today go? What are you doing tomorrow? How's your food? What did you have for dinner? And WhatsApp for desktop, for anyone that doesn't use it, game changer. And I was like, sweet. And just before I left for Australia, I put an email out. Anyone interested in using me as an online coach? It costs an hour's worth, but you get me for an hour throughout the week. And I got like 10 people sign up straight away. I was like, fuck, I've been selling sausages to vegans for this whole time. I've been throwing out fucking the wrong product. And I said to all these people when they signed up, I don't really know what I'm doing. It's £55 or $55 a week. I went backpacking to Australia, and I was earning $500 a week to stay in hostels and travel around. And I got my old MacBook out most days, and everyone was like, what are you doing? I was like, well, I'm kind of working from my laptop as a PT. Everyone's like, how would you work from a laptop as a PT? I was like, I don't even know. I've kind of made it up till I got here. And yeah, then when I came to Australia, I really wanted to get back into face-to-face. I missed that. I like turning up and having your work start at 6 and having it finish at 3. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you're the same, that I sometimes envy the days where my business stopped when I left the gym.
Oh, yeah.
And my mind stopped.
Oh, yeah.
Like now you're always on, always thinking, good idea, content, podcast. Like you're engulfed. And with the flexibility comes a cost. With the Instagram following comes, you know, the privacy issues that you have. And as we've spoken about before, the anxiety of something going wrong also massively increases. So I ran this online business, managed to get a business partner and some very good people around me to then make a more scalable business, which was the Academy, mm-hmm. which was the same offering for a less price. And then I realized I didn't really want to go back into face-to-face because your environment is so important to produce good work. And I felt that no longer could the gym be a good environment for what I wanted to do. And yeah, I do miss it, but at the same time, I've gone from that person spending 10 hours a day with people to being able to bring myself back. And I think that now a word that I've learned is I'm an ambivert, where I like periods of being extrovert and times of being introvert.
Yeah. 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 You like being around people, but you can also do really well being alone for periods of time.
Yeah.
Makes total sense. Do you, sorry, keep going.
No.
Well, I was going to change subject completely. Because you brought up anxiety. Like,
just about to go into this.
All right, amazing. Yeah, talk about it.
So this week, yesterday, or maybe the day before, the CEO of CrossFit, Glassman.
Oh, geez, yeah.
He was very insensitive with a tweet. I'm not backing what he said at all, but I don't think he said it with malice. I don't think he intentionally meant to upset people, but because of that, he has lost so much integrity, business, financially he's going to get stung. And that gave me anxiety because he ruined his reputation and business with one tweet where he was probably trying to benefit the situation.
Dude, I have anxiety thinking about it. I was literally just talking with my videographer Rico about it before. It's crazy. I mean, I don't know. I was talking with Rico. I was like, I don't know what he was trying to say. Like, I don't know what he was trying to say. And clearly it was very insensitive and it was not a well-placed tweet at all, to say the least. The part that gives me anxiety is like this guy who built this incredible business that's changed the world multiple times over, he's losing what appears to be everything. I could not imagine what that's like because of a single tweet. It gives me anxiety thinking about that for sure.
And also what the culture we've seen from the last events over the first few weeks, last weeks or months, is that you have to pick a side immediately. Mm-hmm. There's like, you know, with the Black Lives Matter stuff that's going on, which probably won't get into in too much detail, there was scrutiny and you were ostracized. What side are you on? I didn't post a black square, and I had people in my inbox going, where's your black square? And I was like, you can have my full support, but I don't have to follow this structure of, you know, having to feed what you need from me. And suddenly being anti-racist wasn't enough. And everyone had to pick a side. You're either with us or against us. There was no longer a spectrum. And everyone's turned against this CEO. I feel a lot of the athletes, a lot of the endorsements and the brands.
Yeah.
I have a feeling, and I've got no evidence to back this up, this is completely my opinion, I have a feeling behind the scenes, Reebok might have been reconsidering that offer anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I think that some of the athletes might have been unhappy with the way CrossFit were dealing with things. And I think some of the gyms might have had an issue with their fees going up, but they decided to take that tweet and throw that man under the bus
mm-hmm.
to extreme scrutiny, and then to take their standpoint to boost their own identity as, you know, almost to be sanctimonious. They're like, look at me.
Correct.
I'm not standing for this. I'm against this. And I feel like these athletes have probably had their PR team going, you need to unassociate from that man right now. This is what your post is going to look like. This is the support you're going to get. And the same is going on in Black Lives Matter. There are American influencers going out in the street, getting their photo, then getting back in their car and going home.
It's insane. I work with a lot of coaches as well. So I have like my inner circle for fitness. And I also have something like a business mentorship to help coaches. And I've been speaking with coaches about this nonstop for the last week or so. And you wouldn't believe how many of them, I'm sure you would believe, but how many of them are saying, listen, I stand for this movement, I support them, but the only reason I posted that black square is because I didn't want people to think I was racist. Like, there are so many people posting these black squares because they're scared that other people will think they're racist that they don't. And it's like, this isn't going to change anything if you're not doing good in the world outside of social media. It's very interesting to me how a lot of the people who are like, I got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of DMs demanding me to post it, like, where's my stance? It's like, hold on. You were the first people to say real life isn't social media. You're the first people to say like social media is a highlight reel. But as soon as this happens, you're demanding me to post whatever, like real life on social media. You're demanding me to do this. It's a very odd scenario to be in, especially when you have more and more people getting in your DMs and comments and just literally demanding, telling you exactly what to do with your platform. And if you don't do this, then you're immediately a racist and a terrible person.
Yeah. And so I just see all these black squares appearing. No one's told me about this. Instagram don't DM us and go, hey guys, this is what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to then go externally and go, hey, what's going on here? Like, am I part of this? Do I understand? Then, someone says to me, okay, well, it's to create a white space so that the voices that need to be heard can be heard. And I go, but I'm not hearing them. All I'm seeing is my friends posting black squares. If anything, a lot of my friends that have got a low posting frequency are now posting something they wouldn't have. This is the polar opposite of mm-hmm. what I thought the cause was about. If you want a blackout, surely your silence and your refraining from posting would create the white space. But instead, people decided to fly a flag, which did the polar opposite. And again, it wasn't, in my eyes, a race supremacy. It was like a value supremacy. Like, oh, I'm a great person.
Yeah.
Look at this. And any battle against racism has my full support, and I'm willing to do whatever it is, but there has to be some efficacy. And I just didn't deem that to have the efficacy. And Ellen DeGeneres got shot down for one of her tweets because of using the wrong wording, although it was very apparent that she was in full support. And then people are saying to her, if you really care, show us your donations. Let us see how much you donated. And I was like, this goes against the fabric of humanity. Humanity and having equal values to me is about lifting people up, not mm-hmm. putting people down. And it's about treating people equally, not demanding expectations from them based on what they do. And there's so much scrutiny at the moment on social media, and whether it's pent up from COVID, I'm not sure, but I'm sure you're aware that we are treading on eggshells at the moment. If we didn't feel like we were before, we've just seen someone tweet away his business model. And it's a very tough time where, again, I feel that a lot of people are being scrutinized now for trying to remain positive. And you post a funny video. I bet I haven't seen one of your spoof videos in a while.
That's exactly right.
I haven't seen the wig come out because we're then worried about people going, ah, it's a fucking pandemic. People are dying. Why are you trying to make us laugh?
Man, I got someone literally hours ago saying that the number of people who message me just to tell me that they're unfollowing me is outrageous. But someone being like, I can't believe you're still posting about your, because I'm doing a mini cut right now. And every day I weigh in and I post my weight and like show people how the scale fluctuates. And she was like, I can't believe you're still doing this with everything going on. I'm unfollowing you. And I've been thinking about unfollowing you for a while, but this is the end of it. And I was just like, man, nothing I do is going to be good enough for some people. I will say the overarching response, I made a video, I don't know if you saw it the other night, I made a video because someone DM'd me. They were like, someone I've never spoken to in my entire life, like not once ever in my entire life DM'd me. They just say, you follow Trump? Do you support Trump? And I was like, this is a very odd scenario to find myself in, that someone you've never spoken to, number one, you would never do that in real life in person. Like that just wouldn't happen. Number two, I was like, I also follow Hillary Clinton and I also follow Joe Biden. You didn't ask me about either of them. And it's a very odd time where I feel like people are looking to tear other people down. People are looking to call other people racist. People are looking to tear other people down. People are looking to make assumptions about other people. It's a very volatile time right now. And so, I mean, this definitely goes back towards the anxiety bit. Like, how do you personally deal with anxiety? Like, do you deal with anxiety about your business? About like what do you deal with anxiety about?
I'm good to, my favorite thing is just talk to people. So I've got people around me where I can just express my thoughts about what I am. Am I being, I think that when they say talking about an issue can half its weight, where I'm like, should I be anxious about this? Should I be sensitive about this? Obviously, there are people waiting on the fringes to, you know, like the media are waiting for a story to come out mm-hmm. or for a fucking dick pic I sent when I was 12. Whatever it is, someone's waiting. I'm waiting. And you have this anxiety. And then when I weigh it up, I'm like, you know what? Is it really that bad? And again, imagine this, right? So yesterday, have you ever been trolled on a live before where people just come on and comment random stuff?
I saw your story on this. No, I don't do lives as often as you. So no one's done that to me yet, but I'm looking forward to it now.
I had one about a few months ago, maybe even a year ago, where everyone started coming on my Instagram live talking about a table for sale. I'm talking 30 or 40 profiles being like, James, we hear about the table for sale. And I was like, what? And I was like, there is an organized group of people trolling my live to, you know, say that I've got a table for sale. And I was like, this is very weird, peculiar. And I couldn't get in the mindset of someone or a group or an organization or a faction that would do this. And then I did a podcast with two of my friends the other night where I was like, we spoke about racism, but we did it in a sense that, you know, we spoke about ignorance and the, it's not about making things equal. It's about giving opportunities to people that we don't have, and that there is a tree in life that is leaning over towards us. And we don't see that. And then the people on the other side of the tree are like, hold on, this isn't even, and we can't just give both people the same ladder. And then a lot of people criticized me on that. And my friend is Muslim, and we spoke about him being a Muslim, and he speaks about some of the racism that he's faced. And we laughed with him on that banter, and someone goes, well, you're a racist because you laughed. And I was like, no, I'm with my friend. We're joking about how ignorant people are, right, and how stupid they are. But I had a bit of anxiety when I went to bed, and I was like, I hope someone's not misconstrued my honest opinion as being racist, because I'm not. So I'm on this live, and one person calls me a racist, then two people, then five people.
Oh my then God.
About a collective of 20 or 30 people go, we've seen your old tweet. It's time for you to apologize.
Shut the hell up. Are you kidding me?
No, there's this. And then I reckon there was 30 or 40 people telling me a racist, saying they'd found an old tweet, saying that I needed to apologize. And I was like, what the hell? So the anxiety here, I know it's not true because I'm not a racist. And then I was like, someone taking something out of context. Maybe I was drunk when 8 years ago and I said something that was funny at the time, or times have changed. You know, stand-up comedy 2 years ago was very different to what it is now. Was I quoting someone? And I really had to question that. And then I realized they were trying to get words out of me as well by making up fake names. And I was like, why would someone do this to me? They're trying to bait me into saying things or to be in the standpoint or whatever it is. I was like, what group of people come together to try and get that out of someone? Like, are they doing it for thrills? Are they doing it for... And I can't understand that. And the world we live in is where everyone's expecting you to trip up, to say something wrong. And again, with Trump, do you know what? I probably liked Trump less before he got elected. And then I kind of... It's not my country, but I was like, he won the vote. He's your leader. And if you don't like it, well, there's another election that's going to come up at the end of his term. You're not going to overthrow him or whatever it is. And I was like, the media and everyone, it'd be nice to support your leader, where irrespective if you agree with everything he's doing, because he was voted as part of a democracy that many people have, you know, had to fight for years. Same in the UK. And we go through all of these and we have Boris and everything like that. And no matter what anyone says about him, I say we should support him with everything he says, because that's why we have this hierarchy. And the fact that it's almost like we have the leader of the country, we can ask him an honest question, but instead people are using it as a position to trip him up to make tomorrow's newspaper. And it makes me sick that as a society, that's where we're going. And it's about, you know, throwing people, like finding the witches and burning them at the stake, rather than, you know, looking to, you know, the negativity that's omnipresent at the moment is what gives us the anxiety. I haven't seen, you remember 6 months ago, we go on Instagram and see our friends on holiday. Not anymore.
Yeah, not at all. I remember, I think it was about 2 years ago, or maybe it was 2 or 3 years ago, when my Instagram started to really pick up. I came across an Instagram account. The sole purpose of this Instagram account was dedicated to tearing down fitness professionals on Instagram. Like this whole, and it had thousands and thousands of followers. They would post pictures of screenshots from YouTube videos or screenshots from Instagram posts, or screenshots of number of followers that someone had one day and the number of followers they had the next day. Like, their entire purpose was to look at what fitness professionals are doing and then try and tear them down, and like try and, whether it was tell them to unfollow them, say they're a bad person, say they're buying followers, whatever it is. I'm like, I don't care if what you're saying is real or not. I just think it's very odd that someone's taking their time to make an Instagram solely devoted to try and tear a group of people down. And that's like one of the most anxiety producing things for me, because just like you, it's like you go on a live and you get 20, 30, 40 people saying that you're a racist and demanding an apology. Like, that is scary as hell.
It's mad. And, you know, I was on a live the other day and I said, someone goes, what do you think of what's happening in America? And I go, people smashing into stores, looting, stealing, that is not protesting. That's being a vandal. And someone goes, so you're telling us that Black Lives Matter is just vandals, is just thieves, is just people breaking the law. I go, no, my point was to separate the two. When people ask me what's going on in America, they're insinuating about the protests, and everyone's joined the two together. And I was saying, no, let's be honest. I don't care what scrutiny I get. There is thieving and robbing, and there is peaceful protesting. Just because they're happening in similar locations, someone's taken that out of context and then put that as a post on a completely different post. Say, hey, James, you said the other day this. And I'm like, what are you trying to do here? What are you trying to, you're trying to rile me up in the comments feed? You're trying to get other people on board. And it's like everyone's now doing their due diligence on how good people are as humans based on their political agendas, based on where they stand on these things. And it's just really sad to see. you know, the way the police are treating people, people are treating the police. These are the people we call when we're in trouble. And that's completely gone out the window for quite a long time. And another thing that I can't get in my head is that people are now smashing up police cars that are going to have to be paid for by the state, which is going to have to come out of taxpayers' money. And people are literally, you know, we're going to be facing a recession that is probably not, we're not going to feel the pinch of this. The people, it's quite a bold statement to say, but I can imagine a lot of people out there causing this vandalism are probably on the state. They're being looked after by the state right now for being unemployed. When that money finishes, where are they going to fill the void of all the damage that's occurred to state-owned property? It's crazy. Yeah. I'm really worried.
The whole situation is crazy. Man, at a loss for words, it doesn't even begin to cover it. I think clearly there's issues with police brutality has to be addressed, number one. Clearly there's an issue with that. None of that justifies looting and stealing. It was interesting. I was watching a video because my girlfriend, she used to live in Atlanta. She moved from Atlanta to New York so we can move in together. And they actually, they looted and smashed one of the stores that she used to work at. And so we were watching videos of people coming out of the, which by the way, it was actually very odd. One of the videos was of people taking selfies for Instagram outside of this like burning store and that, or with like cop cars burning. And then she used to work in a very high end store, like super high end. And, there were videos of people coming out and she was like, that bag is over $100,000. She thought, wow. And she, I was like, man, this is, it's crazy that, because I've been called a racist for condemning the looting. On Twitter, someone told me I'm a racist for condemning the looting. And they said that because you're white, you shouldn't say that the looting is bad because you don't know what they've been through. I'm like, listen, what happened to George Floyd was cold-blooded murder. And like any police brutality, like it's all bad, period, end of story. And bad cops should go to prison, period, end of story. Looting is also bad, and pretending that stealing is justified as a result of trying to get back or to, I don't even know, understand like what they're trying to say as a result of stealing and burning. Like walking down the street in New York, there's smashed glass everywhere. When I walk down the street on Fifth Ave, I can like smell burnt rubber from like the night before. I don't understand. And I, to be fair, I'd say that I think the vast majority of people agree that looting and stealing and burning and hurting small businesses and actually hurting real people, because people have been killed during these protests, is not doing the right thing to actually get justice.
Yeah, we should be pulling together as one race to ensure that everyone is, you know, on an equal playing field, that there is no kind of injustice. And yeah. Isn't it mad that right now you put on the TV and you feel like you're watching a film?
Yeah, to say the least, it's surreal. Every day I wake up, I wake up heavy. I wake up like in a very odd mindset, just like, and it's not a good state of mind. And like, I haven't put on the TV for that reason, but I have been spending significantly less time on Instagram than I have in the last like 3 years.
I messaged Darren last night. I go, I don't like social media right now. I said, I don't like it. I go, and you know what, hand on heart, I started writing an email about this today and I deleted it because I was worried about the scrutiny from it, where like, I don't like it. I was like, so many people in the, and I was worried about writing this because I knew of the backlash. I go, hundreds of thousands of fucking people each day go to social media to have a laugh, to have a smile, to go, oh, I've never thought of it like that. And you know, I'm going to get so heavily scrutinized because people go, you know, I say, well, what about all the people that need their happiness from going on social media for a bit? TikTok, where some of the best creative content makes me laugh. I go on there. All I see is looting. I see an old man get punched in the face or knocked over in America. I was haunted seeing that guy hit his head on the pavement. It might have been here. It was in America where there's blood on the pavement. I couldn't unsee that. And I was like, the channels that people are going to improve their state of mind are now negating it. You remember the game in The Sims where you'd see like positive interactions between people? I feel like some people get that from their social media and I feel like they're not getting that anymore. And then they can't really, you know, they can't go outside, they can't go on holiday, the cinema's closed. And I worry every day that people aren't getting these pluses anymore, which means they're going to be getting minuses.
Yeah.
And like your body battery on Garmin or whatever it is, like I'm deeply concerned that the avenues people have to make themselves feel better aren't going to be there anymore. And it doesn't look like they're going to be there anytime soon. And yeah, Instagram as a place, you know, oh, you're not doing enough, you're not doing this, or you don't mean what you're saying. It's a really tough place to be in at the moment. And that doesn't mean I don't empathize and sympathize with the causes and everything that's going on. I'm sure you're exactly the same. But for so many of us at the moment, it puts us in a very tricky situation where we're worried to do what we do.
That's exactly right. And we're in a place where we're worried to do what we do. And by the way, yes, of course, I very much fully support Black Lives Matter. It's interesting. Someone was, even though I've actually publicly stated, which I feel like it's weird that I was demanded to state that, but I very much support Black Lives Matter and very anti-racist. I'm in an interesting position with that. And I don't think a lot of people know this, but someone was like, why don't you support Black Lives Matter? Why haven't you publicly stated it? And I was like, well, first of all, I have publicly stated that I am for Black Lives Matter. But one thing that a lot of people don't know is that in the BLM movement, one of their I don't know if it's in their charter or their manifesto, but they are actively anti-Israel. Like, they are against Israel. They say Israel is an apartheid state, that they're committing a genocide on the Palestinians. And this is just a whole separate topic to really blow into. But clearly, I'm very pro-Israel. Like, I used to live in Israel. I love Israel. I'm just like, Israel for me is like Australia for you. It's like where I feel my best.
Yeah.
Now, the interesting thing about living in Israel is, like, I have friends who are Palestinians. I had neighbors who are Palestinians. We would hang out. We'd have dinner. The media blows a lot of stuff up to make it seem like Israelis and Palestinians don't get along ever. It's like, that's not true at all. Like, when you actually live there, if you haven't been to Israel and then you're talking about this, if you haven't been there and actually interacted with the people and you're just going based off what the media is feeding you, you're having a very, very narrow idea of what's actually going on. But even though BLM is anti-Israel, I still support BLM. And a lot of Jews and Israelis are actively against me for that. So I'm in this weird, like, place where I actually support BLM because I think right now it would be very short-sighted of me not to support them just because of that one view, right? That's not true. I think it'd be very short-sighted. I think right now is a time to actually support BLM, and we can address that later. But I think too many people, they let one view sway way too much of their decision-making process always. And I think we see this in politics. I think many voters, arguably most, are single-issue voters, right? Like, one issue in their mind will sway their entire decision for who they vote for. I think one issue will decide whether or not they love somebody or hate somebody. And for me, going back to this example, even though that movement is actively against, like, one of the most important parts of my heart and where I like want to live eventually, it's still the time now to support them in what they're doing. But don't confuse me supporting BLM with supporting looting and violence, because that is not one and the same. Supporting Black Lives Matter is supporting that community and supporting helping them get equal opportunity. But that is not like condoning violence and looting and hurting other people. That's outrageous.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. On a lighter subject, moving out of that, we spoke just before we setting up this podcast. I said 2 minutes Turkish, and you go, I'm not Turkish. That's Duren. And I said, have you seen Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels? And you said, no.
I've never even heard of it.
You got Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels, which is the first homework film to watch. Then the second one from that is Snatch. Seen Snatch?
I have not.
It's about Jewish people in New York. It's Brad Pitt playing an Irish boxer. You got Jason Statham in it, which is, I'm pretty sure they call Turkish. And it's real English banter and Cockney rhyming slang. And it's a really interesting bunch of films. Yeah, see Brad Pitt as an Irish gypsy boxer as well. It's really funny. And in Snatch, there's 1 minute where he goes, 2 minutes Turkish. And like, English people always, you say it to each other, you're going to be 2 minutes Turkish. But I think you definitely, you need to watch those. And it's a very London, New York. I'm pretty sure the Jewish in it are dealing diamonds. And it's really good. I had a feeling that I thought you might have seen it. But yeah, that's going to be your homework by the next time you come back. And
I thought that was an autocorrect when you said Turkish. I was like, oh, I don't think you meant to say that. I thought that was like an autocorrect that because you talk with Darren a lot, it just came through.
No. So like I used to date a girl from Canada. And I said to her, I'm watching Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. She goes, I haven't seen either of those films. Are they Westerns? And I was like, no, this is a British film. It's like part of our culture. It's like, you know, probably, I don't know, Americans watching Die Hard at Christmas. You have to have your Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. And when we do like another podcast, I want to know what sayings you've taken from the films that you brought to everyday life.
Deal. All right. I will absolutely do that. Man, thank you for coming on. I appreciate it.
No, I have a feeling that we're probably going to do some more over the coming weeks and months. And hopefully we get to do one face-to-face sooner than later.
Likewise, man. Thank you so much. I'll talk to you soon, all right?
Cheers, mate. Thank you.
Bye.
That wraps it up for this episode of the Jordan Syatt Mini Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. James, thank you so much for coming on. Have a wonderful day and talk to you soon.